You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
Welcome to Greenbelt, Jeremy.
Thank you very much. It's fantastic to be here. It really is.
We've been asking Jeremy for as long as I can remember, and it's prescient, given all that's happened, that he's here this summer. And in particular, I want to start with the breaking news. It's a fantastic year for making fig jam, I hear.
Yes, it is. Yes. That is the high news of the year. It really is.
Is that still where you hold your life together, is like the allotment?
Well, the summer's come early this year, and it's been very hot, and it's been very good. And the my allotment has some wonderful people on it. An elderly Greek Cypriot gentleman who was basically planted a fig tree on everybody's plot. Whether they want one or not, he just turns up. He turns up and says, "You need a fig tree." I said, "Do I?" He said, "Yes, you do." So he then plants it, and they grow. And so we've got lots of figs. And the fig jam is the best, wonderful, easiest thing to make. All you got to do, chop off the top, chop off the tail, chop it up, put it in a pan, boil it, add an equivalent amount of sugar, put it in a jar. Job done. Okay. I've made tons of it.
So I can hear some people shouting way out in the distance that you're not hearing. Is that right?
Are you shouting because you...
Right.
Are you shouting because you can hear or because you can't hear?
Okay. Okay. So...
I believe you. Okay, whatever it was you said.
The other big news, of course, this summer is that you've launched a new political party.
Yep.
Can we go...
Yeah. And it's called yourparty.uk.
Can you tell us a little bit about what led you to that decision and what you're hoping
yeah,
to do?
Yeah, I mean, you'll obviously have followed the history of the past few years. I stepped down after the 2019 election and then was suspended from the Labour Party, reinstated, and then debarred from the Parliamentary Party. Then, a very quick version, debarred from running as a candidate for Labour at the last general election and denied the right of appeal against that. And I said that was grotesquely unfair, as did a lot of people in my constituency. And so I put myself forward as an independent candidate. Phenomenal number of people came to Islington to help, and local people also. And we won the election with a very, very large majority. Proved that it's possible to fight the election on a anti-racist platform, one about redistribution of power and wealth, ending child poverty, and above all, peace in the world and total opposition to the sale of arms to Israel for the bombardment of Gaza. And so we won the election, as you know, and a lot of pressure was on me to form a new political party. You know, I didn't frankly want to rush into this because it is a huge undertaking, and there are lots and lots of pitfalls along the way. It's not a simple matter. My principles behind it are, it's obviously with others, first of all, I want to see grassroots politics, community-based politics, community activity, which is why I was very determined as leader of the Labour Party to make it a community-organised party, which was attracted a huge amount of opposition within the hierarchy of the Labour Party. Unbelievable, really, but it was. And then, secondly, I wanted to set out five broad areas of policy: peace, social justice and equality, public ownership of key services like water, water and energy, environmental sustainability, supporting net zero by 2030, and also standing up against the new trend, which is to dismiss all environmental legislation. And the fourth area is one of inclusivity and all communities. We will never, ever blame refugees for the social problems that exist in this country. They are... They are victims of many things around the world, some of which we've caused, wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Libya, and so on. And they're human beings just like us. Where's our humanity? Where is our humanity? And so that's the 5 points of the message. And so far, we've had just over 800,000 people have signed up. Now, it doesn't mean they're all going to be members. I'd be surprised if they all were, but a lot of them will. And so we're doing events all over the country, events like this where we're talking about it, but also ones that we are promoting. So the first big one we're doing is next Saturday in Blackburn in Lancashire, where we've emailed every one of our supporters. Only us can email them because of protecting data. You can't share names and addresses with anybody, so you've got to be careful about that, and we are. A big event there. And we'll use that as a template for how we set up local organisations of it. So I want us to get these local groupings going, which will work with all existing groups, work with existing radical organisations, but above all, be a community-based, coherent pressure for a much more socially just society. And I'm absolutely determined that we achieve that. And so my next few months are going to be taken up with doing meetings and rallies all over the country. And I've just come from doing meetings in Scotland on Friday and Saturday, and we're getting things underway in Scotland, which will be organised separately, as will Wales be organised separately. But it's really exciting and a huge endeavour. And if any of you or many of you have signed up, thank you very much. Emails and stuff are on their way. Lots of info coming. And above all, see you in activity. See you on the streets.
You know, it sounds very exciting, energising. I'm sure a lot of Greenbelters would resonate behind those values, issues that you've set out. But, you know, we had Carla Denyer here from the Green Party.
Yep.
She would say, if she were in my seat, you know, why... That agenda sounds very similar to ours, Jeremy. Yep. Why can't we work together? You know, it's a two-party system. It's a... What would you say to, you know, in our first past the post system, why splinter that vote?
Well, first of all, on the first past the post system, it's got to go. We've got to bring in a form of proportional representation. I want to see it as community-based, in the sense that MPs elected have a direct relationship with the constituency. I think that's very important. And have an added list system to even up the support between parties, so you have members elected on a regional basis in addition to the constituency-based members. Very similar in that sense to the Bundestag system in Germany. Other point is getting rid of the House of Lords and replacing it with an elected chamber, elected by proportional representation on the basis of English economic regions, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. On the question about cooperation, we have an independent alliance group in Parliament, the six of us. We cooperate very closely with the Greens and on a number of issues with colleagues in the SNP, in Plaid Cymru, some of the Labour left and other MPs on occasion. So we are absolutely realised that to achieve anything you have to cooperate. And we will cooperate with the Greens, we'll cooperate with others. But I have to say, I think the demographic that is joining yourparty.uk are not necessarily totally identical to the demographic that joins the Green Party. It doesn't mean they're at war with each other. It just means they're people of different political experiences, different outlooks, a more socialist outlook, I suspect, people joining yourparty.uk. But we've got to work together. I get that. I don't want to see Carla lose. I want to see her win. I have worked with Carla. I've done public events with her, and I will do them in the future. And in my own borough, in Islington, we have an opposition group on the council, which is an alliance of the Green councillors and the independent councillors. And they work perfectly well together. What we've got to do is get together on the principles. And I think the principles that I set out are ones that would broadly appeal to most Green supporters, and I would actually stick to all of that. So, but we can develop something very strong and very good here, and help to frame and shape the whole debate of politics away from the misery show offered by Reform and the way in which the media are so besotted by promoting a very right-wing, very narrow agenda promoted by Reform. I don't know about you guys, I turn on my phone or my computer, I'm sure I've been hacked by somebody, because all that ever comes up on my computer when I turn it on is a picture of Nigel Farage. Straight away, I can't avoid it. And then a relay of something or other from GB News, and so it goes on. Now, that is, if that's happening to me, and I can sort of laugh it off, what's happening to a lot of other people that are getting that message all the time of foul allegations made against people who are desperate to survive? And so fair play and support to all those that have demonstrated in support of refugees living in great poverty in asylum hotels, because we've got such a terrible system of dealing with asylum seekers. They end up living for sometimes years in desperate poverty. And you know what? Tomorrow, some of those people are going to be our next door neighbours, our teachers, our doctors, our lawyers, our train drivers, our engineers. Come on, we're one world, we're one humanity. Let's grow up and be one world and one humanity.
And behind those people who are getting those feeds and those reels into their social media or whatever, whether they're from the right, from the mainstream, from the left, there are also increasing numbers of people who are completely disengaged and completely disillusioned with politics in the way that it works. And how do we fix it? Do you think that's true? And how do we go about fixing that, if you can fix it?
I think it is true. A lot of people are extremely disengaged. And if you're living in private rented accommodation, it's very expensive, and you're above the local housing allowance and you're on benefit, you're probably subsidising your rent out of your benefit. You're quite probably having to rely on food banks in order to survive. And if you are a large family, you're only getting benefit for the first two children, you're losing an awful lot of potential money that you could be feeding the other children with. And you have that sense of anger that's there, and then you're told that the hospital waiting lists, some overcrowded schools in some parts of the country, opposite problems in other parts of the country. It is very dispiriting. And then you got a lecture from the government that they've inherited this alleged massive debt from the Tories, and therefore are going to impose austerity 2.0 on the country once again. You can't cut your way to prosperity. You can't achieve economic change, equality and growth by cutting services to the very people who need them most. And when I heard Liz Kendall get up in Parliament and announce she wanted to take £5 billion out of the personal independence payments budget, and in order to satisfy the Treasury demand to spend £13 billion a year more on armaments over the next 3 years, I think, well, this is unbelievable. What we're saying is we recognise the levels of poverty amongst those with disabilities, and we're going to make it worse. Well, what kind of society is it that deliberately impoverishes people who have disabilities instead of giving them the opportunity to live independently, and if they're able to and want to, able to work and so on that goes with it? We've got to change the dial. But you know what? When you get active and you get campaigning, the hopelessness disappears and the hope comes in. People realise they can achieve things. I'll finish this. I know I'm in danger of going on too long, and you're going to get upset. I really don't want you to be upset. I really don't. No, I don't want to see. I don't want to see that side of you. No. On Friday, I was in Glasgow. I went for two reasons. One was the meeting I'm about to describe to you. The other was to do a Music for the Many event, which we do through the Peace and Justice Project. I went to this hotel chain in Glasgow, where there's been a strike of young hotel workers for the last 3 weeks, I think it is. And they were striking because they were fed up with 0 hours contracts. They wanted support to be able to safely get home when they'd finished their shifts. They wanted a substantial increase in pay because they felt they deserved it, and a number of other things. And these are a group of young people, sort of in their late teens, early 20s. They've been in Unite the Union's hospitality branch. They joined the union They tried to get all these things by negotiation, didn't. They took strike action, supported by Unite the Union, with strike pay to keep them going, and £70 a day, keep them going. And eventually, this group of young people won everything they wanted on Friday, and I arrived there essentially for the celebration. But what was good about it was the sense of hope and confidence in those that had been through this struggle, and how determined they were to say the same to people being exploited, working in Amazon, working in Costa Coffee, working in Starbucks, all those people on 0 hours contracts in the gig economy, they wanted to do something with them as well. You could just see the confidence in them growing. You all know this, you win a local campaign, you go on to win lots of other things. So let's turn the dial around. Hope is the most valuable thing. Let's get some going.
You mentioned, you touched on the decisions that are being made on governments across the West at the moment about prioritising and increasing spending on arms and defence. You've spent most of your life, you know, campaigning for disarmament and for peaceful means. Can you say a little bit about that? And, you know, at the moment you're trying to bring a case that holds the government to account over its complicity because of our involvement here in the UK in arms that are directly, you know, bombing civilians in Gaza.
Absolutely. We, through the Peace and Justice Project, have just produced a book, last year, I think it's on sale here, I'm sure it is, called The Monstrous Anger of the Guns. It's a book about the global arms trade. The title comes from the Wilfred Owen poem of the First World War, Anthem for a Doomed Youth. And one of the lines in the poem is, what passing bells for those who die as cattle, only the monstrous anger of the guns. And it's describing the way in which First World War soldiers were sent over the top just to be mown down by machine guns from either side in that war. And hence we decided to call the book The Monstrous Anger of the Guns. And we put together a series of contributions from all over the world. My partner, Laura Alvarez, who's here this afternoon, was the one who coordinated the writing of the book. And we've described the power and size of the arms industry in Britain, in the USA, in Israel, in India, but also the arms industry that's there in Russia and lots of other countries as well, and the whole way in which the power of the arms industry to lobby for global foreign policies is very great and very, very serious. Last year, the global arms budget bill was $2.4 trillion. This year, it'll be more. It'll soon be somewhere near $3 trillion that is spent every year on arms. That means $3 trillion is not available for health, for education, for housing, for environmental sustainability. And so we've been discussing this book and with a lot of people and having meetings about it in many parts of the country, including discussions with those that work in the arms industry or related parts to it, about how you can promote arms conversion, you can look at different products, you can look at different use of the very brilliant skills. Those that work in the industry are not the enemies. It's the politics that go behind it that are the problem. I've also, as you probably very well aware, been very involved in supporting the Palestinian people and campaigning for peace. I was in Hiroshima and Nagasaki earlier this month for the 80th anniversary. I'd never been there before. I'd never been to Japan before. And I was incredibly moved by the experience of going to Hiroshima and Nagasaki and seeing what had happened and what was actually a relatively small nuclear explosion compared to the size of the bombs today. 300,000 people died immediately. 1.5 million died as a result of it and of the nuclear testing that followed. And so I have been an opponent of nuclear weapons all my life. I will always be so, and support the Global Ban Treaty and support those nations in Africa, Latin America and Central Asia that have all made themselves nuclear weapons free zones. So it can be done. It is possible. If we can outlaw chemical weapons, we can outlaw nuclear weapons. It's something we've, I think, all got to be prepared to campaign on. And then in Parliament, we've been asking a lot of questions about the issues facing Palestinian people. We are witnessing a genocide in real time that's going on now in Gaza. We are watching on television, literally, children dying of starvation, in sight of food, in sight of water, in sight of medicine. We're seeing hospitals destroyed and bombed, and we're seeing the whole livelihood of Palestinian people just completely devastated as a result of it. You've heard Palestinian speakers here this weekend, I know. And a number of us in Parliament, not a majority, but a number of us have been demanding answers about British arms sales, about the use of the Royal Air Force Base at Akrotiri, what the overflying by the RAF is about over Gaza, and the supply of parts for the F-35 jets that Israel uses to bombard Gaza, and now beginning to start bombard the West Bank as well. So I put forward a private member's piece of legislation in Parliament, which was to set up a public inquiry into British policy in relation to Gaza. And I went to the ICJ hearing when South Africa took their case of genocide. And so I just felt we need to expose what the British government, both governments, the previous government and this one, have done in this respect. They then weren't happy with my private member's bill, but it did get through its first stage. They then blocked it, the government blocked it at the second stage, which is what I was expecting. And so we're not going to hang around and wait for an answer from them. What we've done is established our own two-day independent public inquiry, which will be held on the 4th and 5th of September in Church House, Westminster, beautiful historic building, very near to Parliament, very formal setting. And we'll hold that there. We'll take written evidence, oral evidence, and video evidence from many people working in the arms industry, many experts, some journalists, many lawyers, and of course from Palestinian people and victims, and also from people in Israel who are opposed to the bombardment and the occupation as well. It isn't a formal public inquiry, it doesn't have the power of subpoena, and so on. But to me, it's an important thing for us in the Peace and Justice Project to do, to give a voice to and expose what is going on. It's only by exposing what is going on we can help to develop and win that campaign. The global solidarity movement for the people of Palestine is, in my view, unprecedented. And in this country alone, more than 1 million people have taken part in some kind of activity in solidarity with the people of Palestine. That's far, far, far more than ever did over Vietnam, over the Iraq War, or over nuclear weapons. It's the biggest political international movement that this country has ever seen. And so if you're available on Saturday the 6th of September, see you on the streets of London. I'll be there.
But among other things, your long-standing support for the Palestinian people led to you in being mired in a huge controversy over the Labour Party being branded as institutionally anti-Semitic when you were its leader. How do we, as people of good faith, of good conscience, you know, continue to stand in solidarity without falling into that danger of you know being branded and sometimes acting on those anti-Jewish feelings?
First of all, racism in any form whatsoever, is an evil and wrong, and it has to be stopped, it has to be opposed, it has to be challenged wherever it raises its head. I've spent my life doing that, and I'll spend the rest of my life doing that. Secondly, it is important to criticize what the government of Israel does, and I do. It's important to say that the occupation of Palestine is wrong, and of the West Bank and of the Jordan Valley, and I do. It is not right to criticize Israel because the majority of its population are Jewish. It is not right to criticize people for their faith when you disagree with them politically. It's perfectly possible to challenge what Israel does without in any way descending into anti-Semitism in our arguments, our behavior, or our use of language, and we never, ever should. And on our marches and on our demonstrations, one of the most significant groups of people there are the Jewish bloc, who are there in support of the Palestinian people. And we do work with people in Israel who are equally opposed to what's going on in Palestine. Ofer Kassim, who's now suspended from Knesset, is a good friend of mine, and I communicate with him very often, and we talk about all these things. Yes, accusations were made against the Labour Party. I did think there were procedural things that were wrong in the Labour Party. And if anyone reads the details of the EHRC, Equality and Human Rights Commission, report on it, they will also say that even they conceded that I had changed the procedures to make sure there could be independent investigation against complaints of individuals. I stand by the comments I made when that report came out. I stand by what I said at that time. I stand by my total opposition to racism in any form. And I thank all those people that have joined in the Palestine Solidarity Campaign, and all those very significant, very large number of Jewish people that have also said that the accusation of anti-Semitism is unfair and wrong, and what we should be doing is marching together, Muslim, Hindu, Christian, Jewish, whatever faith we are, for humanity, for human rights, and for justice. That has to be the message we put forward.
In terms of government paying for the sort of future that you would like to see for this country, Jeremy, you know, we can make some decisions. Some decisions could be made about the priorities of where spending goes. But, you know, are you a believer, for instance, in what more broadly might be called a wealth tax? You know, is our taxation system really going to do it? We're being told by the current government that it's all about growth, that growth will get us out of this malaise that we're in. But where are you on how we're actually going to raise the funds that will pay for an equal society?
It's a really funny thing that it's always the very wealthy that say a wealth tax won't work, isn't it? They always say that. They must know something. Yes, there are a number of things we have to do. First, the idea that you have to have growth at all costs in order to deal with the current problems. I sort of challenge that philosophy quite a lot. It is surely about the distribution of wealth and how we invest within our society that is equally as important. And the idea that, for example, I've heard Keir Starmer and Angela Rayner say this, the important thing is to get growth going. So we'll remove the planning restrictions on buildings all over the country and remove some of the environmental protections that go with it. That can't be right. It cannot be right. We have to sustain the natural world and the environment. So what I would say is, let's look, one, at inequality within our society. The threshold for paying income tax is people pay far too much income tax on low incomes. I think the threshold to start paying income tax should go to 15,000 and then ultimately raise to 20,000, which would automatically make the lowest earners considerably better off. And in return, you bring in a new income tax rate for those earning over 80,000 and so on. So you balance that out by more income coming in at the top end. You secondly introduce a wealth tax, probably at 1% on those with free assets of more than 10 million. So I don't think it will impact on anyone in this tent. I really don't. But if you've got more than 10 million and you're in this tent, I know you're a generous person and you won't come. You won't complain about it otherwise. Otherwise, you wouldn't be at Greenbelt Festival. And then you have to look globally at the level of corporate taxation. Now, this isn't an easy area, but it has to be done. Global corporation tax rates are too low, and corporation tax in Britain has historically come down too much, and I wanted to put it back up to 26%. But remember, corporation tax is a tax on profits, it's not a tax on income. And so it is not damaging to the sustainability of a particular company. But we also have to look at the question of taxation of the big global corporations, the Facebooks, Amazons, etc. of this world, that essentially play ducks and drakes with one economy after another in order to avoid taxation. You can only deal with tax avoidance and tax evasion on a global scale by acting globally. Not quick and not easy to do, but very important to do. But instead, we have a sort of beggar thy neighbor policy where we have one country after another offering bigger tax concessions to the very richest in the world in order to attract them in to their economy. That can't be right. What we should surely be doing is looking instead at the needs of the poorest people within all our societies. And so it is about investing in the needs of people. And the last thing I'll say on this is, if you raise the minimum wage, if you increase people's income by changing the basic rate of taxation for the lowest earners, if you increase welfare benefits, you're actually putting money directly into the economy because they spend that money. You're getting actually an economic development and economic opportunity coming out of that. And so I think we have to be going in that direction. And so I'm appalled that the government has still not ended the two-child benefit cap, still done all the other things that I talked about. And so what I want to see is a program for social justice and economic justice within our society. And that is what I was very keen to develop when I was leader of the Labour Party. Interestingly, I got Bernie Sanders and I got a note of praise from the Financial Times. I was really shocked. I was so shocked, I read it several times. And they said, those that want to see economic justice and are opposed to the policies of austerity should thank Bernie Sanders and Jeremy Corbyn for speaking up about it and at last starting debate about the dangers of a policy of public austerity and the damage it does to the social infrastructure within our society. I'm proud that we did that, and what's more, I'm going to carry on doing it.
So, Jeremy, you're here at Greenbelt. Greenbelt is known as a Christian festival, inverted commas, that builds more barriers than bridges at times. But, you know, you share his initials. I'm just wondering, you know, a lot of people might think that socialism and the gospel are quite closely intertwined. Others would disagree. Where do you stand on the way that faith and politics perhaps can intertwine?
I think that the basic tenets of Christianity are actually socialist tenets. They are about sharing, they are about concern, and they are about care. And I think, you know, we shouldn't be ashamed of that. Should politicians be elected because of their faith? No. I think we should have a secular political system and be respectful of all faiths, because I think that is very, very important. In my community, we have it's a very diverse constituency, 70 different languages. 70 different languages are spoken, and I'm very proud of that diversity. And we have 5 mosques. We have numbers of Roman Catholic and Church of England, Methodist, and various other nonconformist and evangelical places of worship in the community. And this microphone is giving a double edge. Can you hear me? Can you hear me now? Anyway, can you hear me with that? Can you hear that? Right. Well, let's try it this way around. It looks a bit weird, but let's give it a go. Let's give it a go. It's the sound that matters. And so I do think it's very important to reach out to all those communities and work together. And I've never forgotten one of the most horrific days in my constituency was in 2017 in July. We're in my house. It was very hot summer's evening, beautiful evening. And suddenly I heard a ambulance go by. Not unusual. We live near a very big, very busy main road. And then 30 seconds later, another ambulance. 30 seconds later, a police car and so on. Goodness, what's going on, I thought. So went downstairs, checked out and so on, and then started phoning around and found there had been the most horrific incident outside the mosque up the road. And I then phoned people on the council and the police and so on and found out the true horror story of what had happened. Then I went round to the mosque to talk to the people in the mosque about what had gone on. A far-right individual, consumed with racism and hatred in every way, had driven around the whole community for some time, not clear who he was looking for or what he was looking for. He gave a lot of contradictory evidence. Drove into a crowd of people coming out of the mosque. It was during Ramadan, after they'd come from prayers at about midnight, and killed one of them and injured very seriously six others. The imam from the mosque ran to this site of the incident where the driver of the vehicle that had done the killing was still in the vehicle, and he protected that man from being attacked by a very, very angry crowd whilst the ambulance workers got on brilliantly with their job of trying to save the lives of the remaining people. And I spent the night in the mosque making phone calls, supporting people and so on. And the following morning, we arranged for all the traffic to be stopped in the whole area, and a interfaith act of solidarity and remembrance was held with rabbis, priests, vicars, imams, and people of no faith. We all came together as society in common humanity to remember the life of Makram Ali, but also to say we are not going to allow racists to divide us. And the children from local schools responded to that message. And in one school, they basically said, we're going on a march to the teachers, got a big sandbox, played All You Need Is Love on repeat, and walked around the streets playing that. Fantastic. We at least united the community in condemnation of that. Just think how it could have gone the other way at that very, very moment because of the bravery of that imam who protected a really horrible person who'd done horrible things, but protected him from mob rule, and he's now in prison, and he should be. And so that is where all the faiths can come together, and we have to always do that. When anybody's under attack, we're all under attack.
And we'll move to questions shortly, so I'm hoping that I get a selection of post-its at some stage. But you mentioned, you know, when you said that, you know, socialism has to do with caring for people, there was a purr around the room. You'd expect that from a largely an audience of faith. But why is it then that people, or it seems that people are scared of the idea of socialism? They're almost scared of the left. They think it's a little bit loony, a little bit risky. Why do you think that is, Jeremy?
A lot of people are actually totally infected with socialism but don't know it. They got to find out about it. And sometimes when you're sort of tired and you've had too long a day, you end up doing something you probably wouldn't do under any other circumstances, but you do it. I was trying to get people to vote in a local election one evening, sort of about 9:45 in the evening. And I went to this family and said, you know, understand none of you have yet voted. Is there any chance you could go and vote? It's literally, the polling station is about 200 metres away from your house. Don't know. All right. Okay. We're not sure about this socialism business. I said, okay. Right. What do you think about the National Health Service? It's all right, isn't it? Do you think we should get rid of it and privatise? Of course not. Okay, all right. Oh, I wasn't going to do that. It's all right. So, okay. Now then, what about education? Don't you think it'd be much better if you paid for your kids to go to primary school and you paid for your kids to go to secondary school? I said, what, are you going to do that? No, I'm not, but there are others who might. But don't you think education should be free for everybody? You say, yeah, of course it should. Okay, good. Right, let's try a third one. What do you think about housing? They said, there's not enough of it. Agreed. Do you think there ought to be a duty for local authorities to provide housing for those that need it? Yeah, of course they should. I said, where do you think these three ideas ever came from? The concept of free education, the concept of free health, the concept of universal housing. Where do you think those ideas came from, other than those that believed in the socialization of socialism, of bringing people together? I said, I'm not going to tell any on you. I'm not going to split on you. But I think you're a family of secret socialists. And now, will you do me a favor and go around the corner and vote? And they did.
Okay. So we're going to take some of your questions. Thanks very much. We are not going to get through all of these, I am afraid. This is really embarrassing, having to sort of flick through people.
Yeah. Quick fire answers.
We do. Yes, please.
Is it salt and vinegar, cheese and cheese and onion, that kind of thing, is it? No.
What will your new party's stance be on LGBTQAI rights and specifically on trans rights?
We obviously at the moment don't have policies beyond the five framework areas I said. My view on trans rights is trans rights are human rights and we should treat trans people with respect.
Whoever wrote this, thanks ever so much, because I forgot to ask it myself. It was in my notes. If the Brexit vote were held again today, would you campaign on either side or would you remain neutral again?
What I would want to do is... first of all, it's not going to be held again, but what I would want to do is actually develop what I tried to do, which was to get a customs union trading agreement with the European Union for this country, which would mean that we could carry on with normal trade and access within Europe. And I do support the development of free movement of people between Europe and this country. I was faced with essentially a very impossible position in that the majority of Labour Party members, probably 80% were remain. Two-thirds of Labour voters were of Labour constituencies were against, and basically we could not win an election without the support of both Remain and Leave voters. What I tried to do was say, actually, your social and economic injustice problems are exactly the same whether you're in a Remain or a Leave area. It is a question of how you run our society, and I hoped that we could develop that trading relationship with Europe, which I started to negotiate. We all know what the result of the election was. I don't think this country will rejoin the EU, and I think the EU is moving, actually, in my view, in a very bad direction over its militarism and its development of its own armed forces, which is what Ursula von Leyen wants to do. I want us to see us having an effective social and economic relationship with the European Union, rather than the sort of trade policies that both governments have tried to develop with the USA and other places that ignore both human rights and environmental concerns in development of those policies.
Thank you. You don't need to be too rapid fire because we've still got a bit of time, and that was really helpful. Thank you. How will you safeguard the Jewish community, many of whom are feeling unsafe in the UK, if your new party was, you know, in charge of the country?
We fully support the community, fully support the existence and safety of synagogues and Jewish schools and the right of free worship and the right to practice your faith and your religion. Anti-Semitism is unacceptable in any form whatsoever in our society, and I have always and always will protect the right of people to follow their own faith and their own religion. And so I would make sure they are absolutely fully supported and protected in exactly the same way I would make sure mosques and churches and temples and other things are also equally protected, and work on the assumption that if somebody attacks a synagogue, they're also attacking a mosque and a church. Let's put it that way and say we're all going to defend our places of worship.
Here's a wonderful and heartfelt question. Do you think more should and could be done for people with learning disabilities?
Yes, I think the support that's needed for people with learning difficulties and those with special education needs in schools, which are sometimes learning difficulties, sometimes other things, are very important. The cutback in education spending on teaching assistants, on Senkos in schools and so much else means that the achievements of all pupils are damaged as a result of it. and the numbers of children with undiagnosed conditions means the families and parents often suffer a great deal as a result of it. And so there is a crisis about the spending on special needs education and support for children with special needs and the diagnosis of children with special needs. And that is something that absolutely has to be addressed as a matter of urgency. And that's something that I've been demanding and working with my union and also my own local authority and trying to achieve that.
And you might, and it would be good if you could say perhaps a little bit more in response to this question, Jeremy, because you've already alluded to it in a sense. What are your thoughts on the use of citizens' assemblies locally and nationally to change how decisions are made?
I think the concept of citizens' assemblies and how you bring people together is really good. What I've been doing in my own community since the election last year is to hold roughly once a month a forum at different times and different venues. So we're playing around with the timing, be it early evening, Saturday morning, Sunday afternoon, all kinds of things like that, as a way of bringing people together to discuss a particular issue. So our forums have two parts. One is a brief report from me and what I've been doing as the MP for the area over the past month or so. And then secondly, we discuss with a particular issue. So for example, we discussed the provision of mental health services and the support for people with mental health conditions. And we invited speakers from all of the local mental health organizations and campaigns to speak. And they took a lot of questions. A lot of people who were suffering stress levels also came and talked about it and talked about how they needed help and support and how they were fed up with the stigma attached to those with mental health conditions and breakdowns. And then at the end of it, we didn't let everybody just go away and say, well, that was nice and that was interesting. We said, okay, what are we all going to do about it now? What are we going to do practically about lobbying our health service, our local authority, our schools, and so on? And we agreed on a plan of action to do that. And so that is at a very micro local level, empowering and enabling people. And we did the same for people with physical disabilities as well in the campaign against the cuts in PIP. And so if you bring people together in a discussion, it can be done hybrid, so it can be online as well for those that don't fancy coming out or can't get out to a meeting. It does empower people. I do want to develop citizens' assemblies. So, for example, citizens' assemblies on the form that proportional representation should take, the form of our constitutional rights, because we don't have a written constitution. I remember working very closely with Tony Benn on a Commonwealth of Britain bill, which was about a written constitution, and that would include the right to health, the right to housing, the right to be able to live securely, all those things that are actually alluded to in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. So I think we just need to open up that debate and discussion, and citizens' assemblies are a great way of doing it. People normally come together in adversity. I understand that. Sometimes in adversity, you turn it into a process of going forward and hope, but not always. But if we bring people together on the prospects of going forward for improvement in our society in general, that brings a much more hopeful part to the equation. And that's why I think citizens' assemblies are a good idea.
Here's a good question of someone who's really looking forward. It's good to be strategically thinking. I'm currently 11, and I, of course, can't vote yet, but when I do vote, why should I vote for your party?
Well, yeah, that'll be in 5 years' time, because the voting age, I hope, is going to be down to 16 by then. So we've got 5 years to make ourselves ready, able, and fit to receive your vote, to build a better, cleaner, greener, more environmentally sustainable and more humanitarian society. And do you know what? I think we can do it.
I'm just going to go back to some of my own questions, if that's okay, as we draw to a close. You were talking to me in the green room a lot about how festival spaces are important. Can you say a little bit about that?
Yeah.
I think festivals are absolutely incredible. And I'm sorry I've taken so long to get to your festival. Am I going to get invited again, or is that it? Okay, all right. And so I do think they're important because they give you a chance to... Most festivals have centered around music, not all. This weekend I've been also at the Borders Festival in the south of Scotland in Peebles, which is essentially a festival of ideas. It's based around international peace ideas, and there were people there, for example, from Kashmir and other places, talking about the difficulties of their situation and Palestine, of course. There's the festival we've got here, and then there's big festivals like Bradford Literary Festival, Edinburgh Festival. What I find with all of them is you get exposed to ideas you maybe hadn't been exposed to before. You get a chance to wander around, talk to people you would never normally talk to or bump into. And if you come as a grouping, as a family, whatever, it's a safe space and people can go off and do their exploring on their own. That surely is what the whole point of a festival is. And I was saying to you, I think we should have a thought about whether or not we couldn't get, you were talking about this, doing a festival pass, which can allow people to get to a number of different festivals over the summer, because there are quite a lot of them. I go to quite a lot of festivals, and I find discussions like this, in this sort of atmosphere, absolutely brilliant, because you've got the interaction of ideas in a relaxed and very safe space. And of course, being England, the weather is always perfect every summer.
We had a speaker come into us remotely from Sweden called Dougal Hind yesterday, and he was saying, in terms of thinking about the value of the arts and culture in society, that his observation was that the more affluent and the more, quote-unquote, advanced societies got, the more a luxury arts were considered, just an added nicety, a luxury. Whereas with more primitive societies, his argument was that culture and the arts are way, way more important and fundamental and baked in. What's your, you know, you were talking about the way that the arts is sidelined in education. What would you do about that?
I think he's making a very profound point there, actually, because you think of societies which don't have the degree of material wealth that exists in most of Western Europe and North America actually do have a tradition of oral history, do have a tradition of music and creativity within their own community. And I think that is all very important. What I find sad is the way that our education system over-specializes and makes things over-specific all the time and is continually cutting back on music, on art, on creative work, and on theatre education. And in my own way, I tried to change this around by proposing a pupil arts premium, which would be a protected fund to go to every school that could only be spent on music, art, and theatre and creative education. Because it gives all young people a real chance. In my own area, we have a number of local theatre groups. The one I'm most associated with is a group called Angel Shed, where children come, they write their own plays, they perform their own plays, and they come together, learn a lot about each other, and learn a lot about creativity, and feel very good about themselves from doing it. And I think creative education is very important. We've done this Music for the Many stuff through Peace and Justice Project by holding concerts in music venues that are under threat. So, for example, the Lead Mill in Sheffield, under threat, as a number of others are. And so the idea being that we want people that form a band to have somewhere to play, somewhere to rehearse, and somewhere to perform. And that's where you get the creativity in music. If we continue with this cutting back on music education in schools, then it will only be those families that can afford private music lessons away from school that will still be able to enjoy playing their own instrument and developing music. And the orchestras will be populated by those that have been privately educated, because interestingly, the private school system is very keen on music, is very keen on all of these things, because they see the importance and the value of it. I want the state schools to be as good or better than all of them on music, creativity and cultural education. So let's hear it for the state schools.
And who are your heroes, political or otherwise? You know, who's shaped your thinking and formed who you are today?
Wow. You didn't warn me about that one. Ooh. Well, lots of people, I suppose. My mum, my dad, they did a lot because they were of a generation that stood up against fascism in the 30s. They were a generation that was there at Cable Street fighting the fascists when they were going after the Jewish community. They were them, so they were inspiring. And then there were great political figures that I've had the privilege and honor to meet, like Mandela, Tony Benn, and others, have been to me very inspirational. But what I would say is, don't always go looking for heroes and don't always go looking for symbols of things. Some of the wisest people you meet are not necessarily those with lots of letters after their name or those that have been to lots of universities. There's often a great deal of wisdom there with your next door neighbour, with the person that's cleaning the street or whatever else. And I'll finish on this. When I was a school kid, I used to deliver papers on a Sunday. And I used to take them to the end of the round to one house where there was an old guy and his wife lived. And he was a retired farm worker. And he was then probably about 80 or well into his 80s. And I got to know him very well, and we'd often chat about things. And he lived in this tiny cottage, and he'd worked on farms, two or three farms immediately in that area all his life. In his whole life, he'd never been more than 5 miles away from his home. Never, ever. And he asked me what the town was like where I brought the papers from that morning, because he hadn't been there for 20 years. And I said, well, Ernie, his name, but I said, Ernie, do you want me to take you there? He said, no, I don't want to go there. Why would I want to do that? I said, all right, sorry I asked, you know. But you might say, well, wow, he must have been a really narrow-minded old son. Not one bit of it. He knew every centimetre of every hedge and every field that he'd ever worked in. He knew everything about the ecology and sustainability of the area. And he actually had a very good understanding of human behaviour and human knowledge. He was somebody that had left school at, I think, 12, no education whatsoever. To me, he was actually a very wise man, and he taught me a great deal. So let's not ever be too high and mighty about who we can learn from.
And just to close, can I bring us back to what feels like just the most urgent, glaring and screaming situation that we face here in a field in Northamptonshire, and that is the situation in Gaza today. What is it that we can do? Because I guess if I'm anything to go by, you feel helpless. And what can we do, Jeremy?
Helplessness is something I know we all feel about this. I've been on every single demonstration on Gaza and the West Bank. We're coming up to another one on the 6th, which I talked about earlier. It's been my privilege over many years to visit Gaza and the West Bank on 9 different occasions. And I've also been in Israel. I've also been in Jordan and Lebanon and Syria. And I've been to the refugee camps, the old refugee camps, as well as the newer ones. The situation is dire, awful, horrible, and ghastly. based on the idea that somehow or other Israel has assumed for itself the right to occupy the West Bank and expel the entire population, and now to try and bribe the government of South Sudan to accept the Palestinian population. They're wrong, and they must be stopped in doing that. So we have to continue on the demand that we no longer supply any arms or weapons whatsoever to Israel, to isolate them politically because of what they're doing to the people of Gaza, and give all the support we can in practical help and aid, and trying to get those that can be helped with urgent medical needs out of there to be brought to hospitals here, Italy, or wherever they can be got to. But it does mean being silent won't achieve anything. I've been incredibly angry with our government, both our government's responses to this. But I have to say, I've noticed in Parliament the way the language has changed the more the demonstrations have taken place. Don't suppress the right to demonstrate. Don't suppress the right to speak out. Don't suppress the right of us all to make our views known to our government. That's why we're holding this public inquiry. That's why I'm asking all of you that can to take to the streets of London on September the 6th to show your solidarity with the people of Palestine. If we were up against it, and if we were up against it in Palestine ourselves, the least we'd expect is from decent, good human beings all over the world at least come out and shout in our support. So let's do that on the 6th and every other day as well.
So, Jeremy, our hour together has come to an end, and I would like to thank you and Laura very much for making time to stop off at Greenbelt on your way back to London. I hope that you'll come back. I don't know what you've made of us. perhaps you better not say.
I think it's brilliant. I think it's really good. I really enjoyed it so far, and I'm going to be here for a bit longer. So thank you very much for inviting me.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.